You're listening to the Podcast Detroit Network. Visit www.podcastdetroit.com for more information.
Hi, guys. This is John Lafferty with Century 21 Town & Country. You can reach me at 248-652-8000, or you can email me at the number 4UISEL@gmail.com. So that's 4UISEL@gmail.com.
And this is Tony Abate. I am with Ross Mortgage. You can reach me via phone or text at 248-821-5411. And my email is TABATE@RossMortgage.com.
And today we're going to talk to you about five tips for millennial home buyers. And if you were born between 1982 and 2000, you're considered a millennial. So our five tips today that we're going to get into are really things that you should consider when you're getting ready to buy a home. Sometimes it's things that you can really start thinking about when you're a senior in college. So first on our list, Tony, is getting approved by a reputable lender.
Yeah, super important. So there's no replacement for being prepared for the home purchase, and there's no specific advanced time that a person needs to do. As soon as you think that this is something that you want to pursue, we need to set up an appointment. There's a lot of fact-finding that needs to happen for the pre-approval and just being prepared for the home purchase. And the better equipped you are to jump into that, the better the experience is going to be for you.
So if we're taking a step back and we're thinking about maybe that college student who's maybe in their junior year now or in their senior year, what are some of the things that they should be thinking about or doing to get themselves in a good position once they graduate from college?
Sure. So one of the primary obstacles right now for first-time homebuyers coming out of college is student loan debt. It's a top-of-mind topic for everybody that is a recent graduate. And in fact, far and away, that is the largest debt that young folks are dealing with when they consider a home purchase. So knowing how that student loan debt is going to affect a home purchase and layering in other things that you can do to offset the impact of that student loan debt is an important thing.
What are some of the things that somebody who's going to be graduating, mm-hmm. And let's say they get that first job, mm-hmm. And when you get a new job and you're making more money than you've probably ever made in your life, that first job, one of the things that you want to do is reward yourself. Sometimes that means leasing a new car. Sometimes that means buying things to reward yourself, adding to that new wardrobe, but is that the smart move?
Yeah, you really got to be strategic with this. By the time a person is wrapping up college, those student loan balances are kind of water under the bridge. It is what it is. You're going to have some repayment options, but it's going to be there, and you need to know that that's going to have an impact. However, the other choices, John, that you were talking about, such as that car purchase or other major spends that can happen on the heels of getting that great new job, those are the things that you want to take a good close look at, because that can make the difference between whether you're able to buy that first home or you're not able to buy that first home.
Yeah, that's good advice. And one of the things that you and I were talking about before is if somebody has, let's say they go to U of M, they come out of U of M, they have $120,000 in student debt, mm-hmm. they get that first job. It's a really good job. Are they able to buy a home? Are there special programs out there mm-hmm. that allow them to be able to buy a home with that much debt?
Right. That's such an important question. One of the things that typically happens when somebody comes out of college is their student loan debt is deferred. So there's a window of time when they're not making the payment on that debt. However, from a lender perspective, we absolutely have to consider that debt. And if the idea is to pursue a home purchase sooner than later, options such as income-based repayment plans, where that student loan repayment is tiered or stepped to increases in income over time, that can make a tremendous difference into the purchasing power for that new graduate.
That's great. So, So the common wisdom of, hey, you got all this debt, you're going to have to start paying it down. Maybe when you're 35, you can buy a home. That's not true. There are things that can be done so that somebody who's got a good job out of college, maybe a year or two, could be in a position to purchase a home.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, the reality is that short of living with family, you're going to need to pay for a roof over your head anyway. So if you can position yourself by looking at student loan options and with the help of a lender that can kind of guide you through the qualifying, then you can find yourself able to purchase a home sooner than later. If you instead choose to rent for a period of time, that's a real tough treadmill to get off. And the conventional wisdom is, well, I'm going to rent and save some money. Well, two things happen. While that person's renting, the home prices are not staying static. They're rising right along, right? And then the other variable is we know what interest rates are today. We have no clue, regardless of what kind of predictions are published, we have no clue what they're going to be later. So it's very hard to save at a rate. You say, hey, I'm gonna purchase a home. I'm not gonna purchase a home now. I'm gonna rent instead. My ideal home is $200,000. But then, after a couple years of leasing, and you have saved up some money, that very same home is going to be 10-15% more in price, and then the interest rate could be an increase as well compared to where they're at now.
So they actually lose ground.
Absolutely.
They
absolutely
take themselves out of the
market. Right. And if you're renting, you know, you may not be paying your own mortgage payment, but you're paying somebody's mortgage payment. So it's really what's the best way to maximize your dollars for your housing expense. And far and away, the mortgage payment is going to be more advantageous than paying the rent.
Ah, that's so true. So one of the things that we get asked about all the time as realtors is about the difference between getting pre-qualified, mm-hmm. getting pre-approved. What's the difference? What am I providing? What is being desktop underwritten or having desktop underwriter approval, DU approval? What does that all mean? Can you kind of go through the differences, what your typical pre-qual, pre-approval, and DU all kind of mean in the differences?
Right. Great question. You know, unfortunately, that's a segment of the lending business that is not heavily regulated. And so the thing to be mindful of is that these terms, pre-qualification, pre-approval, et cetera, those can both be a definition of what's happening with your application, or they can be a marketing tool by that lender, and you certainly need to be careful of that. In broad terms, lenders will consider a pre-qualification as just a discussion and a blank sheet of paper. We're scratching out numbers. We're giving an idea. But nothing's verified. We haven't pulled credit. We haven't verified income. We haven't looked at assets, et cetera. It's a reasonable place to start, but it's not going to carry a lot of weight from a purchase standpoint. Then conversely, a pre-approval, what we do at Ross Mortgage is that we take a full mortgage application short of having that property to analyze. So we've got the application on file. We've got paycheck stubs. We've got bank statements. We've got tax returns, et cetera. And we're going to put all that stuff in front of the underwriter who has the approval authority. So then what happens is that once you know that you're at that pre-approved stage, really the only thing that has to pass muster is the house itself that you're purchasing. It kind of puts the onus on the seller.
Can I stop you there for a second? Mm-hmm. So if somebody is providing you this information, does that mean that they're committed to you? So in other words, I'm going to give you my tax returns, my Social Security numbers so you can access my credit, pay stubs, other things. If I give you all this information, are they committed to you or are they still able to shop around?
No, that's a great question. They're absolutely able to shop around. You know, we wouldn't want to remove that tool from a potential home purchaser. With most lenders, there is no cost to a pre-approval, and there's certainly not a commitment. You know, we want to do what we can to earn your business and earn your trust. But the lender that has the low rate today may not be the lender that has the low rate when it comes time to purchase the house. And so a home buyer wants to have that flexibility of still do appropriate rate shopping.
And also, just to piggyback on that, one of the things that I think is important too is the interest rate that you're quoting them is based on the information they provide. So if they don't provide you all the pertinent information, and there's something in there that's a derogatory on the credit or something else that could affect their credit score, that's going to affect the rate you're going to give them.
It absolutely can. And if you look at the webpage from an online lender that happens to be posting interest rates, it's really important to scroll down to the bottom and look at that teeny tiny print at the bottom of the screen, because the disclaimers and the variables of things that can impact an interest rate are numerous. And as a home buyer, you're getting ready to borrow a lot of money and spend a lot of money. So you certainly want to know how those mechanics come into play and know how, you know, what is the low interest rate that's advertised versus what's your interest rate going to be for your own personal situation.
Yeah. Okay. And desktop underwriter approval or DU approval, if you could just talk about that for a moment.
Sure. So stepping back a bit, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which are you know, not quite household names, but they're somewhat known. These are entities that purchase mortgages from lenders. And in exchange for that, they kind of get to write the rules of engagement. And what they came up with probably 10, 15 years ago is an automated underwriting platform. And there's some tremendous benefits with that. For Fannie Mae, it's called DU or Desktop Underwriter, and for Freddie Mac, it's called LP or Loan Prospector. What these do is that they analyze all the moving parts in a person's finances, you know, the income, the credit score, the liabilities, the assets, and it'll either give a green light or it won't give a green light. Now, these systems can have a path to approval, but they don't decline a loan. You know, if something is not meeting the standards, then it is going to go in front of an individual to give a deeper review. One of the big benefits of these automated platforms is consistency. So an underwriter is not going to make a different decision on a loan approval because they've had a bad day or they've underwritten a bunch of tough files.
Isn't that so true?
Or they got yelled at by the boss. And the other very, very important reason is that it removes the ability to make discriminatory lending decisions as well. The answer, the outcome is the same regardless of anything that might fall into a discriminatory category.
Yeah. Okay. So when you're deciding, if you're a buyer out there and you're deciding to tap their toe in the water for getting an approval, they're starting to look at homes. Does it matter where you get it? Does it matter if you go online for that quick 15-minute approval? Or does it matter if the lender is local? Maybe you go to one of these national websites and get a pre-approval generated for them. Talk about the difference between those things, getting one online, using an out-of-state lender, or versus using somebody local and actually sitting down with them in person to get that pre-approval. What are the differences, the challenges, if you compare and contrast those?
Sure. So I'm going to have a little bit of a bias because I am a local lender.
Well, sure.
But that works well for a variety of reasons. And the first thing that I would say on that, John, is that if you're doing this in an online format or speaking to somebody who is really just gathering information over a 1-800 line, all they know is what you tell them. They're not necessarily going to ask questions about, here's what our qualifying is, but Mr. Homebuyer, what are you trying to accomplish? What's important to you? And what ends up happening is opportunities can be missed or a person can be put into a position that just doesn't financially fit for them. A good example is for veterans. You know, there's a wonderful loan program that is a benefit to those that have served the company with the VA loan. If the lender never asks, you may not be able to embrace that benefit if you're a veteran. So I think one of the important things with the local lenders is that dialogue, that Q&A that can happen to not only look at the qualifying, but also look at that home buyer's goals and lifestyle and all those things that truly do come into play. Again, you're getting ready to borrow an awful lot of money. You know, there's more to it than just entering data in forms and hitting a button.
Yeah, for sure. One of the things that I'll share with you that have happened a few times with out-of-state lenders is homeowner associations. Mm-hmm. So yep. We're not talking about condos, but residential homeowner associations where it's $300 a year for the association, and maybe most of that goes towards maintaining the entrance mm-hmm. to the subdivision. Well, out-of-state lenders have had issues with homeowner associations because most of them don't have bylaws. Most of them don't have documentation to provide to a lender, and there's always a disconnect. And I've had that happen on several occasions where it stalled a deal mm-hmm. because this buyer was using an out-of-state lender and the lender's underwriter couldn't wrap their head around our homeowner associations here, especially in subdivisions. So one of the things that that I've come across just with using out-of-state lenders on top of they're never accurate when it comes to taxes, figuring those yep. things out, especially if they're going to do impound accounts. And mm-hmm. I'm probably getting in the weeds here. But anyways, that's good information, especially for somebody who's looking at what's the right choice here, who's just getting ready to jump into the market. So, okay, so now you have somebody in front of you, mm-hmm. a buyer, and what determines which way you're going to go with them? If they're a veteran, mm-hmm. Then probably you're going to look at a VA to see if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. But what are you doing to when you're sitting with a buyer? Are you looking at their financial information, credit score to determine FHA is a better program for them or conventional is? Are you looking at down payment? Just a rough of how you determine which way a buyer needs to go.
Right. So it is a work in process, and it's something that comes out of that dialogue. And you know, what we start with is putting all the options on the table. And then as we talk to that home buyer and learn a little bit about their income, their credit, the assets available, then we can either highlight a particular loan program or two or eliminate some that just aren't going to be the appropriate fit. At the end of the day, what we want to do is not just get them into a loan program to get them to the closing table, but get them into the loan program that's going to offer the best terms, lowest costs. And it goes beyond the numbers. You know, if somebody is looking, let's say that their employment involves regular job transfers, well, the structure of the mortgage is going to be different for somebody who might be in the area for 3 to 5 years as to somebody who's looking for that forever home. You really don't get that type of feedback when you're attempting to do this in an online environment.
Yeah, that's absolutely for sure. And we'll get into the different kinds of loans mm-hmm. and how they can actually affect whether or not a seller may or may not accept your offer. Mm-hmm. And so we'll delve into that. So moving on to number two of the five tips for millennials, let's talk about what kind of home somebody is looking for. So you as a home buyer, you have a couple choices. You can either look for what we term a starter home or a forever home, depending on where you are in your life. So if you're looking for a starter home, typically that means something a little smaller, where you can learn about homeownership and build equity while you're learning about being a homeowner. Another thing is in your starter home, you probably don't mind if the home needs some updates, maybe some cosmetic upgrades, maybe a little bit of a remodel to maybe the kitchen and the bath. A starter home. And if you're moving into a starter home, you're probably only going to be there 3 to 5 years. And you want to be there a minimum of three because that's when the home becomes exempt from the capital gains tax. So that's important. You want to be there a minimum of 3 years. 3 to 5 years is a sweet spot if this is your starter home. And another thing for if you're looking for a starter home is it in a good area? And if in 3 to 5 years you decide to sell it, is it an opportunity that it could be a good rental for you? And that's another thing to take into consideration. Is it in a good area that could be good rental property, especially if you don't need to sell it? So those are all things to consider when you're thinking about a starter home. Tony, anything you want to add to that?
Well, that's a great point. You know, real estate as an investment is hard to beat. And, you know, at that point in time, a person might be participating in an employer 401ks or contributing to IRAs, and having a piece of rental real estate just kind of allows you to say, hey, I don't have all my eggs in that one basket. And compared to just purchasing a rental home outright, if you've purchased that home as a primary residence, you're able to embrace all those options for first-time home buyers, minimal down, et cetera. And now you're going to move on to that larger home. You retain that first home. And again, with that next home, you don't have to be making that really, really large down payment. So you kind of get the best of both worlds.
Yeah, that's a great point. So if we're talking about starter homes, now we're going to move on to forever homes. And in a forever home, some considerations that you might want to take into account is this home that you're looking at, is it something that you're going to be able to raise your family in? Is it large enough? Does it have enough bedrooms? What's the location like? Is it in an area that you plan on spending the next 15 to 30 plus years in? What about the schools if you plan on having children? How good are the schools? Have you taken that into account and done an evaluation of the local schools in that area? And also, if you're going to be there for 30 years plus, and we've come across a lot of people, you and I, mm-hmm. for people who have been in their homes for 30, 40, 50 years and had no intention of moving. And I think one of the things, if you plan on being in your forever home for that period of time, we all get older. There's challenges later in life when you have stairs that you have to climb to get to a bedroom. Mm-hmm. So maybe you take that into account. Maybe it's a split level home and the master bedroom's on the first floor and the other bedrooms are up. How big is the property? How difficult is it going to be to maintain? With grass and landscaping and upkeep. And so these are all things to take into consideration for a forever home. Tony, anything about forever homes that maybe from your perspective that somebody should be looking at as well?
Sure. So it goes back to that dialogue of trying to figure out what that home buyer's goals are. The way we set up the financing for a first-time home buyer who is going to only be in that home for the typical 5 to 7 years versus the person who says, this is it. This is the home I'm going to raise my family. I'm going to be here in a long time. The finance choice strategies are very, very different. If somebody's going to be in a home short term, and not to diminish the importance of this, but the interest rate has far less impact compared to the person who is going to own a home for 20 plus years and may have that mortgage for a very, very long time.
Yeah, very true. Okay. Moving on to number three, and this is a tough one, needs versus wants. For our first-time millennial home buyer, your needs versus your wants. Sometimes we think we need something until we sit down and actually think about it. So there's a lot of homes out there, and the being able to find a house that ticks off all of your wants and needs is darn near impossible. So being able to figure out how many bedrooms am I willing to have, how many baths, maybe I can add a bath in the basement later on if I like this home. Layout, updating, has there been remodeling, style, do I want a ranch, do I want a bungalow, a two-story, what areas am I interested in living location-wise? And then maybe you'd like a two-car attached garage, but the home that ticks off most of the other things is a detached one-and-a-half-car garage. Are you willing to settle for that? So it's really figuring out what you really, really want or what you really, really need and what your wants are and what you're willing to sacrifice.
John, we work with clients that are kind of on the same timeline of what they're trying to accomplish, and they're talking to both of us, and it's interesting. I'll be having that pre-approval dialogue, and they'll be talking about this very topic, and they kind of go into it with the idea of, boy, it's really going to be hard to look at 50 or 60 homes. And I always advise him at that point, you know, please have a selfish conversation with John. You really need to identify, I have to have these items. I'd kind of like to have these items, and then let John work with that criteria, you know, and then you're able to, you know, kind of carve out those 40 homes that aren't coming anywhere near. Maybe they popped up on Zillow with a search, but they're not meeting their criteria. And they need to trust that once they give you that list of the needs and wants, that you can evaluate that. And they're, from my perspective, outside looking in, their home search becomes far, far, far more efficient. It's just a better use of their time.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a lot of times where a client will find a home and send it to me and say, I really want to take a look at this home. Mm-hmm. And I find myself going through their lists of what they absolutely want and what they're willing to compromise on, and it doesn't have several things on their list. Mm-hmm. And so we end up not going to see that home because I just bring up the fact that these are the things you said it absolutely must have, and it does not have that. And also, one of the things that I also find is typically when we start out with a first-time home buyer, they have certain areas they want to live in. I want to be in Royal Oak. I want to be in Ferndale, mm-hmm. or I want to be here. Okay, that's great. Here's our price range we're dealing with. Here's how many homes are available currently. Here's how many homes are kind of available in the last 6 or 8 months in that price range. We're going to have a really tough time finding something. Yeah. How patient do you want to be? And we're going to get into this actually in a minute. But one of the things that I'm finding is, you need to be a little more flexible on some of the areas. So you want to live in Ferndale. Well, have you thought about a couple of the communities right next door, like Hazel Park or Oak Park, East mm-hmm. Oak Park, that are really close and you can walk to downtown Ferndale from these areas? Yeah. So that's one of the things that we do as well is we make suggestions and we try to expand a search. Sometimes buyers are very specific about what they want and where they want, and that's fine too. If you're patient and willing to wait, that's great.
Yeah, that's a good point, John. And again, kind of talking to folks on the other end of the conversation, what I encourage them to do is if our strike price is $250,000, just for an example, and they're looking at a few different communities, what I really encourage them to do is, you know, give John this information and he's going to be able to tell you, well, in this community, your $250,000 is going to get you this and you're going to have X number of choices. If we go over here, you're going to get these additional amenities or lesser amenities and these are your choices. And so it's really an important conversation to kind of define what that price is going to get you and how it impacts the different areas that a home buyer is going to look at.
Yeah. Yeah. On to number four. Number four of our top five tips for first-time millennial home buyers is to be patient in your search. It's I can't stress this enough. It's critical. Sometimes, depending on what a home buyer is looking for in a home, could be a specific style, could be a certain number of bedrooms, finished basement, could be any number of things that it may take 3 to 6 months to find that right house, depending on what time of the year they're jumping in, right, Tony? I mean,
absolutely.
It could be if we're looking in December, January, or we're looking right now and somebody is looking for something specific in a community, there's a good chance we may not find that until late spring, early summer, when the majority of the houses start coming on the market.
Yeah.
So there's it may take a while. But then on the other hand, there are others who happen to be in a sweet price range that find a house right away. So it's all about just being patient and working with your realtor to find the right home for you. One of the things that we've experienced over the last really since I'd say 2014 is when the multiple offer mania hit.
Yep.
And mm-hmm. so as a first-time home buyer, I would just say that being patient also comes with maybe taking some losses. There's a chance that you may find a home that you feel is the right one for you. And for whatever reason, there may be another offer or two or five on the table and you just lose out. Mm-hmm. It could be price. It could be terms. And what do I mean by terms? What I mean by terms is they may have given the seller more occupancy because the seller wanted to stay after closing. Also, terms are financing. Mm-hmm. And Tony, this is one of the things that you and I have talked about a lot is if we have a chance to get a buyer into a conventional loan as opposed to an FHA loan, we want to do that. Mm-hmm. And the reason being is why?
Sure. So a great question. So just to back up just a step. So a conventional loan is what we all see as the typical vanilla 30-year fixed rate loan or 15-year fixed rate loan that's advertised online or on TV. FHA loan is a great financing tool. It's a government insured loan. And unfortunately, it comes with some unfair stigma. And so if there's two offers on the table, and they're identical, but one's conventional and one's FHA, the seller, you just need to be prepared for the idea that the seller may have some unfair bias towards accepting a government loan. And the reason is that in past history, those were finance choices that were it took longer to close. They may come with the need for repairs to the home. In many, many years ago, they came with additional costs that the seller had to pay that they wouldn't have to pay now. And unfortunately, not every seller is educated to recognize that it's not a bad choice to accept that government financing. But it's something that as a home buyer, you need to take into account, you know, whether it's a fair bias or an unfair bias. A seller may make their decision about what offer to accept based on the type of financing you're bringing to the table.
Yeah. And you would agree, though, that having a realtor, a buyer realtor representing mm-hmm. you who understands what an FHA loan may or may not require of a home, and that means when walking through a home with an FHA buyer, walking through, looking at different things, looking for the red flags mm-hmm. that an FHA appraiser might call out in an inspection, and having a conversation with the listing agent about the offer and pointing out that that I don't see any potential issues with or FHA appraiser issues with the home. So I don't see any reason why FHA should be viewed any different than a conventional loan in that case. So it's important to have an experienced realtor in your corner to be able to talk about that with a listing agent.
That, you know, that is so critical, John, and that kind of helps unwind some of those unfair biases. You know, agents like yourself who have been doing this for a while, you're going to be able to take a look at a home and know with some pretty reasonable assurance this one may not be the best fit for the FHA loan. But if you're a home buyer and FHA is the best fit, then, you know, you've strategized on their behalf as well. You know, if there's greater flexibility with that buyer and, like you mentioned, with the occupancy that they can offer, or maybe the offer price is a little more robust that can offset the fact that it's an FHA home purchaser. At the end of the day, the money that the seller gets at the closing is just as green on an FHA transaction as it is on a conventional or a VA or a rural development or any of them. It's all about informing the buyers and sellers, educating the buyers and sellers, certainly preparing the buyers to make sure a transaction goes nice and smooth.
100%, 100%. Mm-hmm. That money is just as green either way. So there's, as we mentioned just a moment ago, there's a chance that you may lose a home or two that mm-hmm. you put a bid on. So with that in mind, you know, and I mentioned this just a moment ago, we were talking about maybe considering other areas. So that's another thing that I think is important is to be open to maybe more than just one area, right. Especially if your price, your pre-approval limit is of a certain amount that only a certain number of homes are going to come available. There's a lot of areas that you can expand into to be maybe around an area if your price range doesn't allow you to be actually in a specific area. So it's good to be open to that.
Right, right, right. And that's great advice. And, you know, the other thing to take into account if a person is a first-time home buyer, and not to diminish of the, you know, the importance of the choice, but this is not going to be the home that you spend decades in. And so you look beyond the idea of, is it in the perfect area? Does it have every single thing on my list? The answer is, you know, very likely no in both of those cases. But what this home really is it's a stepping home to, Johnny used the perfect term, the forever home. So in addition to looking at location and wants and needs and so on, you look at, well, how is this going to serve my long-term benefit of getting into that next home? We talked about the one strategy of keeping a home as a rental. But the other aspect is, well, when I sell home number one to buy that forever home, how much equity can I expect to get out of it? And, you know, as they say, past performance is no guarantee past performance is no guarantee of future results. But there are certain areas that just have a history of greater appreciation and so on. And so that's an important aspect with that first home, is say, well, you know, when I sell that, am I going to maybe get a more robust selling price out of this area than maybe that area? Tough to predict. There's no guarantees. But I think that's part of the thing that comes in the choices with selecting that first home.
Yeah, good points. One of the other things that I wanted to mention too, that kind of falls under the be patient category, is really good chance that the home you're looking for isn't on the market yet.
It may not be, yeah.
It may not be, and it may not be for several months. Yeah. So it's all about strategizing and just knowing that if you're starting your search November, December, let's say you're in a lease and your lease is up in June, you probably want to start looking for a home December, January, because it's going to take you that long to figure out, really parse through wants, needs, what you're willing to sacrifice, what you're not willing to sacrifice. And that comes with looking at homes and layouts and styles. And so when you do walk into the right home, you're going to know it's the right one. It's all about just being patient and finding that right one. And you know, I've seen it so many times where a buyer says, this is what I want. This is what I'm looking for in a home. These are all the things I feel like it has. And then we walk into a home that is kind of not like what we've been looking at, you know what mm-hmm. I mean? Yep. And they fall in love with it and say, this is it, got to have it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I've seen it so many times.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, the other part that comes with the patience is and taking some time to look through the different options that are out there is learning the neighborhoods. And, when a person does a home search on Zillow or Realtor.com or any of the online services, they'll never highlight the negatives. They'll never talk about the fact that, well, you know what, this is a beautiful home, but it's, you know, 1,000 feet from the end of a runway. Or when you're
or railroad tracks,
or railroad
if you're in
tracks.
Ferndale, right?
Yeah, exactly. Or if you sit outside the home at the end of school, well, what do you know? The students use your yard as a cut through when they're walking home. So just having the ability to have that patience, learning about the neighborhood is certainly one of the benefits too.
Yeah, that's so key. Yeah, we see so many of things like that. pictures are angled just a certain way of the house, so you don't see the jalopy next door and, the house is in fall down condition it's right on a corner, right? And here's an alley and there's the commercial building and there's the main road right there.
Yeah. Corner lot doesn't tell the whole story, does it?
Yeah. Never does. Yeah. Number five, lastly, of our five tips for the first time millennial home buyer, this one's important, is to have an experienced full-time realtor in your corner to negotiate, to give you unbiased advice, unlike parents and close friends.
Excellent. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I come across that a lot is when I'm dealing with a first-time home buyer sometimes, we will go out, we will look at places, they find something they really like, and then the parents are coming. Yeah. And you know, you can't fault parents for wanting what's best for their children, mm-hmm. but parents, I think, are looking through it as eyes as, well, this might be my child's forever home, or this doesn't look like a good investment to me because this isn't done and this isn't done. Right. But this is where having an experienced realtor with a lot of experience. Just having a realtor.
Time on the water.
Yeah, time on. Thank you. to be able to coach you and direct you, and especially what you're looking for in a home, finding it in a good area. Those are all things that somebody with experience and knowing the price range, knowing when to tell you that you might be overbidding on a home. Mm-hmm. Those are all real important things. One of the things that I come across when I'm on the listing side, when I'm working for a seller, is I can always tell when I'm dealing with a realtor on the other side who doesn't have much experience, who is mm-hmm. kind of green, who maybe has had their license for a long time but doesn't do that many deals. Now, should I look that information up? Maybe not, but I do because I want to know who I'm dealing with on the other side when I'm working for a seller. And I do the same thing when I'm working for a buyer. Mm. I want to know if the seller agent on the other side has a number of years of experience working with sellers. So I kind of know who I'm negotiating with and against. And that, I think, keeps me informed and also keeps my buyers informed. So when I tell them, hey, look, this is the price range in this neighborhood, and I think if we go above this number, it's not going to do well for you. It's not going to suit you, especially if we need to sell in 3 to 5 years. Mm-hmm. Or I've dealt with relocation buyers who may be transferring out in a year and a half, and we really have to be tight on the numbers that we offer because they have a real small window of error.
John, that's a great point, and you excel at that, I will say that. And you know, one of the interesting things that happens is that, you know, let's face it, the home purchase is the largest purchase and most important purchase that most of us are ever going to make, and something that should be very objective and analytical and a little bit cold really ends up being a rather emotional decision process. A person can really get themselves into trouble if they're winging it and they're either doing this on their own or they're working with an agent that doesn't have appropriate experience. Somebody like yourself needs to help them find their center and kind of keep this a little bit cold and objective so that the proper decisions can be made. It's critical.
Yeah, you just hit the nail on the head, and that's taking the emotion out of it. So you as a buyer, of course you're going to be emotional about the house that you love, that you want to buy. Of course you're going to have that strong emotion and attachment to that house. But that's why you hire somebody like myself who takes the emotion out of it. I'm excited for you, but I have to now go negotiate for you and get you the best price and terms that I can. And along the way, if we do get our offer accepted, there's going to be things that are going to come up that might be issues during an inspection, during an appraisal. And to have somebody who can tell you how it is without letting emotion get in the way, I think is really important.
Yeah.
And it's a sound advice.
Yeah, John, anecdotal story related to that. I was working with a purchaser that was very passionate about a certain breed of dog. That was their life. They were committed to it. They were knowledgeable. They loved this particular breed of dog. And sure enough, as they were house hunting, they found a seller that also had that same interest. Well, all of a sudden, that seller's home was trumping all the other homes that were on the choices simply because of that commonality with the seller. Which, let's face it, should have nothing to do with that home choice, but it really, really did in these folks. The seller and buyer got along. They had that common thing that they both enjoyed, and it skewed their decision making.
That's God. You just reminded me of I had these buyers a number of years ago who fell in love with this condo, mm-hmm. and the sellers happened to be home while we were walking through showing it, and they both found out that they were originally from Chicago. They started talking about reminiscing about the old restaurants and the places mm-hmm. they used to hang out, and they had this immediate connection. And so when it came time to write the offer, well, of course, because the buyers were so excited about purchasing a place where somebody who was from their same town had lived, that they kind of may have let slip right. that they really loved the place. So when it came time to write an offer and submit it, we were kind of sunk.
Yeah.
We really kind of had no room to negotiate. But fortunately, they listened to me, and I said, at this price, it's never going to appraise, and we need to just walk away. And as much as I know that they were disappointed, we did walk away. Conversely, 6 months later, they bought a different condo in that building at a much better price. So it worked out in the end.
Yeah, it is so easy in the home buying process for objectivity to fly out the window. And John, like you said, a full-time experienced realtor will help rein that in and allow that home buyer to make the appropriate choice without being skewed by the wrong things.
100%. Mm-hmm. All right. That's the end of tip number five. Those are our five tips for first-time millennial home buyers. Want to thank you for listening to our podcast today. This, again, is John Lafferty with Century 21 Town & Country. You can reach me at 248-652-8000, or again, you can email me at the number 4 and letters UISELL at gmail.com, and that's 4UISELL at gmail.com.
And this is Tony Abate with Ross Mortgage. You can call or text me at 248-821-5411, or you can email me at TABATE at rossmortgage.com. Thank you.
Thanks for listening today.